Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everybody. We're here with Dr. Lawrence Friedman, who wrote the very compelling book, Love's Prophet, which is a biography of the German-American psychoanalyst Erich Fromm. Hello, Mr. Friedman.
Hi there. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too, and thank you for making yourself available. Maybe we can start with you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, by way of background, might I actually start indicating what Erich Fromm would do every New Year's Day, which indicates a bit about him. He, at a tremendous expense, would have salmon from Alaska flown in for dinner every single New Year's Day, which is his love of life. Now, my own background, I don't have salmon flown in. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. My grandparents and my father and his brothers came out of the Holocaust and made it. My parents then went from Cleveland to Los Angeles, and I basically grew up in Los Angeles and went to the University of California for all of my education. I became a professor in history, but also in psychology in large measure. And the first teaching job was at Arizona State University. The second was in Ohio, again at Bowling Green University, the third at Indiana University, and for the last 5 years I've been at Harvard. I love to write books. I love music. I love hiking. And I love good food, as we had last night for New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm. And there you have your commonality with Erich Fromm and his love for food and love for life.
Yes, no salmon, but I wish I did.
So tell us, how did you come to write this biography? What was compelling for you about Erich Fromm?
Well, on two levels. One, I started to write a book on the intellectual emigres from the Holocaust. The Holocaust always been central to me. I remember as a kid in Cleveland in 1945, my father taking me to a movie, and there was the newsreels then, and I saw there one appeared of the liberation of a concentration camp. And I asked my father afterwards, and fortunately he was a great father. He explained it to me, and he said, when I'm a little older than five, I should read with him Erich Fromm's Escape from Freedom. That was the first introduction to Erich Fromm. The second step in this was in 1958. I'm 18 years old, ready to go away to college, and my grandfather and I are watching my old Mike Wallace show, and he's interviewing Erich Fromm, and he says that Fromm is the greatest psychoanalyst since Freud, which may be questionable, but then in the course of the interview, Fromm spoke about his diverse lives as a political activist, a personality theorist, a student of the Old Testament, and on and on. And it became clear there were the lives of Erich Fromm in the title. And that launched me into it. Then when the project on the emigres from the Holocaust was a gigantic project, I moved to one of them, the most compelling, Eric Fromm. And why he, as opposed to 8 or 9 other really brilliant people, won this childhood experience. And the other, I identified him as someone interested in politics and in ethics. And that's been both are very important to me.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you research and write on this book?
Much too long, 9.5 years. It was the most difficult book I ever wrote. And that was in some measure because after Fromm died, his wife, Anise Freeman, burned a good chunk of the letters. But in the process, I discovered something they don't teach you in graduate school. You can't burn letters. You've sent them to someone else who has those letters. And so I discovered, for example, that his good friend, sociologist here at Harvard, David Reisman, there were about 400 letters back and forth. And so I had to go all around the world to find these letters, but it became doable. And also, it became many years of work.
Mm-hmm. Now, since this is a podcast about spirituality, you had mentioned previously that one of the commonalities between you and Eric Fromm is your interest in the Bible. So tell us, how did he get interested in spirituality?
Well, I'll get at really, if you one wants to go early, my grandfather was a Talmudic scholar. And he would be reading the Jewish Bible and other sources, and he would tell me, come study with me. Well, that's the beginning, both of the focus on the Old Testament and on the Talmudic scholar tradition. And I think I became a professor from that. On the other hand, my mother and father were both political activists. Spending a huge amount of time, largely in causes like racial equality, social justice. My father later became a member of the ACLU board of directors. My mother founded the Older Women's League. This was kind of the way I grew up. So the political Fromm I identified with my parents. The student of the Old Testament was my grandfather who got me into it, and both continue to this day.
You had mentioned Fromm's book, You Shall Be Gods. What is the message of this book?
That, to me, is my favorite book. It came out in 1966. And the key message here is that if that this deity or whatever one wants to call it, the in essence, the Old Testament calls for ethics, not worship of anything up there, but being ethical toward others on earth and doing so very concretely. Now, I see another message of sorts when you read this book, and I hope everyone does, and that is it's looking at the Hebrew Bible as music, and he's reading it to us as music. I have never had any such experience before. It's just a beautiful book. So the mode of the presentation is, I think, fantastic. The theme of ethics between us is what's important, not whether there is or isn't a deity is central. I think that's very important, too.
So he's saying it's not about God, it's about human relationships?
Exactly. It's about how we relate to others. It doesn't, you can believe in God or you can't, but the real test is how you conduct yourself toward others.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about the parallel to music.
It's when you read it, and I've never read a book like this before, you're hearing. You're looking at the words, but you're hearing the words. And I don't know the trick that allows this. It's just amazing. And it's like you're in an experience of people singing, playing instruments. And I think in the end, it's Fromm's way of saying the Old Testament, especially the Hasidic tradition, which he thinks is very nice, is life, is embracing life, that the Old Testament is a book of life, of joy, and the essential message is love and caring for each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think he mentioned in that interview that you talked about with Mike Wallace that we have to come out of hiding and become full expressions of ourselves in order to be connected and bring joy to other people.
That's right. He got it. That was 1958, and he said it. And I'd urge everybody to go to YouTube and watch that interview. It's really vintage Fromm.
Well, how did he expand on his spirituality?
How did I understand about what?
How did Fromm expand on his spirituality when you say he started with the Talmudic writings,
yeah,
right?
I say yes. Well, I think the Talmud, he identified with prophecy and a prophecy of love and caring. The way he looked at that and what he took out of it was an activism, a worship of joy, and actually a respect for women that he took out, which is very early in the game. His clinical approach was built around it. It seems to me, and this is I've linked to this, so much of his life grows out of his early study of the Hebrew Bible. He's receptive to Zen Buddhism because it's a connection between people on a very deep, humane level. If you want to look at all of Fromm's themes, in fact, I'd venture to say they're connected to the Hebrew Bible. Now, one thing we haven't yet gone into is the fact that he jumps to the Bible for the first time on a serious level as his home situation with his parents becomes horrible, unlivable. And he embraces an uncle who takes him to that, and then he embraces a number of Talmudic scholars. And what I think that did, it was a kind of stabilizer in his life over the mess at home. It held him together, gave him direction, gave him a sense of himself. So in essence, I think that Ye Shall Be As Gods is his most beautiful book because it was the Talmudic study that pulled him out of the mess of childhood.
Mm. What kind of mess was that? What made it difficult for him to grow up in his parental home?
Yeah, well, it's when you have, to summary it, a manic father, a depressive mother, and the two despising each other, you can't grow up in that home. You've got to get out, have a different orientation. And lucky is very fortunate for him. He had an uncle, Ludwig Krauss, who pulled him out and started the biblical tradition, recommended various rabbis, and that pulled him out. That basically allowed that Old Testament scholar to come out in all of life.
What was Fromm's connection to Buddhism?
I think the connection in part was that he saw in the rabbis and then made friendship with the Zen Buddhist leader, D.T. Suzuki, he saw something fairly similar, ethics between people. Suzuki voiced it a bit different. It was a emotional, spiritual connection that did not have dimensions of time or space, that moved you into the other person into you. It was like the Quaker inner light of God. The inner light is in the self and connects to all other selves. So this basically, I think, was very attractive to him because it connected to his Old Testament study tradition and the ethical relationship between people. It's really interesting. If you visit Fromm's house in Guernavaca near Mexico City, there's a cottage in the backyard that he built for Suzuki, giving him privacy and yet nearness to Fromm, where they could experience not only the Buddhist tradition, but the Jewish tradition as well. It's a very important connection for him. And let me say also that on the way of becoming the Erich Fromm we know, not only the rabbinic tradition, but embracing Suzuki helped him kind of calm down, relax, gain a sense of confidence, gain an orientation. In other words, they were building blocks over that miserable household he lived in.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the relationship was like between Fromm and Suzuki?
I think they loved each other. I think it was very, very close. And when Suzuki died, Fromm was really broke up over it. It got to the point where Suzuki would visit him every year. And whenever Fromm was in New York or later in parts of Europe, he would visit Suzuki. They were very important to each other. And Suzuki helped to give him a sense of stability, orientation. And I don't know in the literature whether anybody has talked about the connection between Zen Buddhism and the rabbinic tradition in Judaism, but it's there here for both of them.
Do you want to elaborate on that connection between Buddhism and the Talmud?
The Talmud is in essence ethics between people. And when you find that level of ethics, there is an emotional flow of caringness and concern. It's pretty well the same with Buddhism, only it's more silent, more on a felt level. It's very clearly devoid of specific time, place, and all. There was a meeting. Fromm invited Suzuki to a conference in 1956 at his home in Guernavaca. And people were having trouble understanding because often Suzuki would just sit there and say nothing. And then Fromm elaborated what was going on, and Suzuki agreed with it. He could understand and put into words a Suzuki that many others couldn't.
Sounds like a very strong connection, like a soul connection.
Yes, that's right.
Now, how did Fromm come to be one of the most prevalent representatives of humanistic philosophy?
Should we take a year for that? I think we would look at everything he does as a form of humanism. That is, he starts with the Hebrew Bible, and that's an ethical relationship, and he picks up on that. Then he comes up, his big, in terms of personality theory, his big concept is social character, which means that there's something within us, and I think he's talking about a humanism or a spirituality that's within us that is shaped by the society around us, the institutions, the traditions of the society around us, and that makes us what we are, the combination of inner feelings, inner emotions, and outer social frameworks to give form to that. And, you know, I was in class a month or so ago teaching William James. And James has an essay in 1904 on how to avoid reductionism. Basically, James said that a subject impacts an object, changing the object. The changed object goes and changes the subject and back and forth. In other words, everything is in motion. When you freeze something, you make it simplistic. I think Fromm was doing that in his concept of social character, that there's something within this inner self that's shaped by the society that in turn shapes the inner self and back and forth and back and forth. If you want to find someone who is non-reductionist, it's from on social character. And back to your question, his humanism was that. Label people, don't pinpoint them, don't give them labels. They're in flow all the time. So that's certainly it. Now, there's a quality from I don't care for, and that is he talked about central relatedness. And that is basically a break from Freudian orthodoxy where the analyst largely listens. It's a situation where the analyst and patient both open themselves to the other fully. My problem with this, this was his approach, is that there's no transference or counter-transference for that matter. It's soul to soul, which you see in his Talmudic and his Buddhist tradition. But is it terribly good in dealing with a client? Is it useful to open yourself to the patient and vice versa? Can you guide a patient when you've said everything about yourself to him or her? Now, as a professor, I would not want to teach that way. I would not want to open myself and my life and all to my students because I think I couldn't be a very good teacher to them on that front. But you see that spiritualism, that linkage nature that he came with in that, whether good or evil, it's simply part of him. And another humanist tradition that's really important, and I think is a much better one, is in the 1960s and 70s, just as their signs, the Cold War is breaking up, and that countries like Yugoslavia, Austria, and so forth are breaking from the Soviet Iron Curtain, Fromm connects to those people and forms what they all call the Third Way. And the Third Way is socialist humanism. It's not the corporate capitalism of the West. It's not the state bureaucracy of the Soviets. It's something they think that's more viable. It's democracy. And it's a situation where everyone eats and is taken care of. They push that third way, and when you look at the political history of the 1960s and 70s, it's very viable. But again, we see from, well, he's calling a book with this group, Socialist Humanism. It's the caring for the other, unlike the West or the Soviets. So that's certainly a big factor there. And let me throw in one other that I don't treat this way in the book. Fromm has a major role in probably the biggest crisis of the 20th century, the Cuban Missile Crisis. What basically happens is, as he's running for president, Kennedy reads an article by Fromm in Daedalus magazine on the need to move very quickly to disarmament. And the strategy here is, look, rather than demonize the Soviets, let's make a deal, in essence. Let's push heavy toward disarmament. Let's propagandize the world that they reciprocate, and back and forth and back and forth, and maybe they can beat us and give us a better proposal. And so forth. Kennedy wrote that, read that, and he's starting to talk about it as the last several months of the campaign in 1960. Then during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he rereads that article. And then right after it's over, he calls Fromm. And we don't have, the White House doesn't have a record of what's said on a telephone call. But according to Fromm's friends like David Reisman and Carl Kazin, the ideas of the Daedalus article came up. If you want to avoid something like the missile crisis that almost blows up the world, get this dialogue going back and forth toward peace, not toward war. And finally, Kennedy in his American University speech of June 1963, it's there. The whole article is there. And the article is giving and taking, connecting to the other, and try to expand the connection. That's probably the most important connection of Fromm to someone in considerable power with this ethical rapport between one and another, up the other person, up the ante in terms of ethics, not in terms of hatred. So these are some of the examples. If you want another 100, we can spend a week.
Well, that was a very powerful example, certainly. One of the things humanism is known for in the psychoanalytic community is that they moved away from the pure pathological view of people to a more motivational self-actualizing point of view. Tell us more about that.
Okay. The person I think very important, more important than Fromm, in fact, I've done a book before this on Erik Erikson, who stated overtly, look to someone's assets, not their liabilities. Build on the assets, not what's wrong with them. So that was there, and Fromm knew Erikson. In fact, Erikson's concept of psychosocial identity and Fromm's of social character are very close to each other, and with it, look at assets, not liabilities. Now, another part of Fromm that I think connects today and connects to a tradition after him was interpersonal relationships. And he got that heavily from Harry Stack Sullivan and Claire Thompson, who he worked with. And by interpersonal, it's, again, this connectedness to the other. But with Sullivan, it's a much more situational connectedness. On that St. Elizabeth's ward where he worked with patients, it's their social connection with each other, not so much the inner feelings. But he took off on that, and of course, because it's compatible with this ethical rapport between people. Self-actualization, I wonder, this is a good question, it's a difficult question. I'm searching for information, and I'll give you one thing. Abraham Maslow was, of course, a key person in the self-actualization tradition. And that tradition, of course, is where you start with basic survival, you transcend that, you go to another level of employment and another level, moving toward happiness and fulfillment. I found in Maslow's library, his books, which are at the University of Akron's Psychology Center, that every single book is marked up with Fromm and claiming that he derived, in essence, self-actualization from Fromm. Now, that's maybe stretching it, but I think a number of the self-actualization theorists found a kinship with Fromm, though I'm not sure that Fromm found a deep kinship with them. You've asked a really difficult question, and a good one, therefore.
So you're saying that much of other theorists leaned on Fromm's thinking to develop their own philosophies?
Yes, I think so. And especially his premise that the social is as important as the inner emotional. You want to build a better world with people feeling better about themselves. You change the social situation. He's a very strong reformist. You know, he brought psychoanalysis to Mexico in the 1950s, and just about every one of his trainees is into social work, changing the societies, dealing with poverty, and so forth. And they're getting that from Fromm. They wouldn't have gone that way without him and his overwhelming stress on the social. So a number of people have picked up on him. It's interesting today, with a lot of stress on the interpersonal, that you have a pickup on Sullivan, but you have a pickup today on Fromm as well.
Right, and that makes me think of the term of the collective. So much in the spiritual world today, when people talk about spirituality and transcending time and place, people start talking about the collective. And it sounds like Fromm has been talking about this all along, only that he called it the social and more cultural aspects than the
That's right. And you're on. He had a different label, but same phenomenon. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to his best-selling book from the 50s and 60s, The Art of Loving. Why do you think that made such an impact on the readership of the times?
Let me preface that with the point that Fromm, throughout his life, sold 100 million books. Can you imagine 100 million books globally? That is, every one of his books is read widely. The lowest selling is 1 million copies. And of course, the highest is 30 million, The Art of Loving. And I gave my students a test. I said, I'd like you to read Escape from Freedom, but you can also read Art of Loving. Every one of them read Art of Loving. And I think what you find there is a sense of authenticity, of it's the real stuff. The book has, on one level, a pretty clear-cut theme. Love consists of loving the self, which will move you to love another, which is love all of humankind. Another thing, though, because that alone isn't going to give us 30 million readerships, on another level, he's putting in elements of some of his love letters to the woman, Anise Freeman. After some false starts with others, he finally deeply fell in love with. And the letters, they're funny as can be. The letters, oh, dear, I go to the office. I'll be back for lunch at 2. What can I get you, dearest, and so forth. Every letter like that. She's in New York. Enjoy yourself. Don't money pinch. Go to the museum. Eat good meals, etc. It's a joyousness in those letters that we would all like to feel in our lives there. And I think that is what is in there that makes it so compelling. You know, Irving Goffman, the social psychologist, said that the so-called banal, you know, dear, I love you forever and all, is probably the most important kind of discourse we have. We certainly use it more often than any other, and Goffman said it's meaningful. Well, Fromm brings those love letters where he is deeply in love into a book on love. And that is why I think the Harvard bookstore here, every Valentine's Day, Art of Loving, is in the front window. So that's it. And then another factor, too, is that for Fromm, love is the counterpoint to hate, to Holocaust. Love's the only sane answer, as he puts it, to the problem of human existence. It was a bloody 20th century, and it was full on the, as well as the butchers, the Hitlers, and Mussolinis. You had plenty of people pitching to lie of love, and we still want it very much. And I think Fromm, at a level of those love letters with the quotes taken off through the book, has hit it. It's authentic. It's what we want.
Now, you called your book Love's Prophet. Yeah. What was prophetic about his way of thinking in terms of love?
I think the love theme integrated everything else we've been talking about, really. It integrated the connectedness, the ethics, the feeling exuberant about life. Now, why is he doing this in a prophetic mode? Well, it seems to me that in part the prophetic is rooted in his study of the prophets when he was moving toward a rabbinical career. He stresses a lot the ancient Hebrew prophets, especially Amos, Isaiah, and Hosea. And I think he moves himself into that prophetic mode, which may be for the worst. It's hard to say, but that's there. And so then he finds others he admires, especially a man named Robinkoff, who is one of his teachers in the mid-20s, where they are doing something that's both biblical tradition and Buddhism, feeling, connecting silently to another. And Robinkoff is, for him, a prophet. So I think the important figures when he was young were prophets, and he moved into that as a model of sorts. It's certainly an asset. It could be a liability if you're wrong. But I think that's why the most important message he offered, he felt, was love. And it was, and the tradition he connected with was the prophetic tradition.
Tell us more about that prophetic tradition.
The people he admires, after you go from Rabinkoff and Nobel, the rabbis, and then Suzuki later, and David Reisman, his close friend at Harvard and so forth, they're all they're people he deeply admires, but they're people who stand for ethics and who have some resources to counter the demons and killers of the 20th century successfully. Now, let me give you a story that I think captures that. Fromm quickly goes, as the Holocaust takes hold, leaves Germany, and by the mid-30s, he's in the United States. But and most of his family got out. But there are a couple of people who didn't get out by choice. There is a woman who is Sophie Englander and her husband. And they're both teachers. And they decide in Berlin, where they live, that it's their city, it's not Hitler's. So they stay until, of course, they're taken to the concentration camps. But what Sophie Englander does is create a chain letter for the whole family, summer in Russia, Canada, America, Mexico, all over the world. And each member of the family writes something on that letter. And it goes on, you know, we've had a baby who's 6 pounds, 6 pound weight, and so forth and so on. And as that letter circulates and every member of the family writes something, including Fromm from New York, the letter is an odd thing. I've never seen anything like it before. It's the letter serves the form of a kind of glue that pulls that family together as it disperses because of the Holocaust. It's a very important document I found. And I think Sophie Englander is telling Erich Fromm, we can be humanistic, we could be caring. This is the tradition of the prophets, gluing us together, connecting us together. And that lesson isn't lost on Erich Fromm. So I think if there's a hero in this story, it's this Sophie Englander. And I never knew that a chain letter during dangerous times can hold us together. So that's, I would put her teaching, helping to teach Fromm a bit of more of the prophetic tradition. But, you know, there's a flip side to this. Fromm always thinks he's right. He's always got the answer because the prophets he identifies with would come to it. And that isn't always the case. Now, he's right with the main prophecy, love. But there's a lot else in life that's more complex that he may not be right on. And his colleague at Harvard, David Reisman, told him that several times. Don't be so sure that you know everything. So that's the liability of the prophetic tradition. The strength far outweighs it.
So how does that tie into maybe his personal love life? In the book, you've mentioned that despite his very strong and deep love for his third wife, he did end up having affairs. What do you make of that?
Well, I wouldn't do it, but I'm old fashioned. I think one has to contextualize it. That is, he's the Frankfurt School, where he was in the 1930s largely, he with Adorno, Horkheimer, other really important thinkers, they had affairs. That was, in a sense, his model. Most of them had affairs. Most were disrespectful of women. With Fromm, I think this is the sort of context, but he keeps searching for the woman he would love with no reservations and would feel comfortable with, and didn't quite find that till Anise Freeman. That is, it's a try and so forth. Now, so that explains in part the marriage situation. Now, the affairs are largely growing out of, I think, the therapeutic approach of central relatedness. You open yourself to a patient, she or he opens himself to you, and you learn a lot of detail back and forth. Well, Fromm, we know, basically be very excited with a beautiful woman, an attractive woman, and these are the women he had affairs with. It was, again, why I find this central relatedness very dangerous here. Now, just a word on context. These affairs were bad, but they were not regarded as bad in the 1930s, 40s, as they are now, and they justifiably are regarded as bad now. But I think these affairs were victims of central relatedness. And it's very hard for a female patient to resist this. So I think all of it was a problem. And fortunately, we're even more angry, upset with it today.
Finally, I was wondering if you can speak a little bit about what God or the term of God was for Fromm.
This is another great question you're raising, but a hard one. For Fromm, it's, as we've noted, the interpersonal and ethics in the here and now. But he knows that a lot of people, patients and others, give a great deal of credence to an external deity. And he's fairly respectful of that in the sense that if that worship of that deity makes you caring and decent to others on earth, that's fine. And if it doesn't, that's not fine. And here another connection I find to William James. James's great book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which says you can worship anything. And it's a good thing as long as it makes you happy and makes you decent to others. And if it doesn't, it's a bad thing. I think Fromm is ultimately like James, though he is not believing in an external God. He's willing to have that if others behave decently and have a joyous life.
What does it do to a writer when you are immersing yourself into the life of another person for more than 9 years?
Oh boy. There was an essay by an Alan Ryan in a review in the New York Review of Books, and he said at the end, it's hard to tell whether Friedman likes Fromm or doesn't like him. And I think that's accurate. I think that what I came out with is someone who respects much of what he does, especially with Kennedy, but disrespects much of what he does, like this these affairs. I guess it came out, I wasn't totally connected, immersed in Fromm, but I wasn't not immersed. I like him and I don't like him. So that's what it did to me. And the bottom line below that is that all of us, we should admire people for what they give us. We should reprimand them for qualities that hurt others. I guess that's what it was like. And it was the first book I've written where I both connected and reprimanded at the same time.
Very wise final words to admire. Admire people for what they offer, but understand that they are human after all. Well, thank you very much, Professor Friedman. It was a lot of fun talking to you. I really appreciate you taking the time on New Year's Day to talk to us.
Well, thank you for asking great questions. It was like taking a doctoral exam again. It was terrific.
Well, I'm glad you got something out of it.